and national board member at WBAI, the People's Media Network. Join the Tribune March 21st at 5 p.m. to register. And for more information, visit lynnstewart.org. That's lynnstewart.org. Or call 917-603-6160. That's 917-603-6160. A tribute to Ralph Pointer.
All right, and the time now is 5 p.m. Stay tuned for Deadline NYC with Tom Robbins here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Here's some advice for you, friend. Don't press your luck. Lay off of me. Don't print that story.
What's that supposed to be? An order?
Listen to me! Print that story, you're a dead man!
It's not just me anymore. You'd have to stop every newspaper in the country now, and you're not big enough for that job. People like you have tried it before, with bullets, prison, censorship. But as long as even one newspaper will print the truth, you're finished.
That noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
It's a city full of fun. I say, welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. Yeah. They got plenty of rats and roaches. Enough welfare for everyone.
Because that's Leon Thomas on vocals, Johnny Hodges, alto sax, welcoming us to New York, or at least the New York of 1970. And before that, the unmistakable voice of Humphrey Bogart played the tough guy newspaper editor in the 1952 film classic Deadline USA, telling the racketeer, there's no way, baby, to stop a free press. My name's Tom Robbins, and that's where I got the name of this show, which I call Deadline NYC. Not so long ago, the name Jimmy Breslin used to really light up this town. For years, Jimmy Breslin had, as he was often only too glad to tell you, the biggest name in New York City journalism. In the late 60s through the 80s, it was almost impossible to miss Jimmy Breslin. He was most famous for his street-level stories about New Yorkers that he told in his day job as a columnist for many of the big papers, the old New York Herald Tribune, the New York Post, the Daily News, and Newsday. He wrote novels with titles that became part of the American vernacular, like The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight, or his book about the then hapless New York Mets, Can't Anyone Here Play This Game? But there was even more Breslin. In 1969, he ran for citywide office on Norman Mailer's mayoral ticket. He was name-checked in the bestseller Portnoy's Complaint. Breslin, that precinct station genius, Philip Roth wrote. He appeared in beer ads on TV. He had his own TV show for a while. There was a swanky restaurant on 52nd Street named after him. He was enough of a celebrity to do the opening on Saturday Night Live at least once. That's not even mentioning the big journalism awards he won, including the Pulitzer Prize. But aside from that blustering, boisterous personality that left such an imprint on this town, the biggest reason that James Earl Breslin, who died in 2017 at the age of 88, won the applause of his readers as well as those of us who worked with him, was because he almost always managed to do something magical with the stories he chose to write. His chosen public posture was this somehow kind of a cynical, self-centered character with a fondness for drink, even long after he completely stopped drinking. But the real Breslin, the man who was inescapable in his writing, was someone with a deep rage against injustice, an indelible sense of empathy for those he encountered in the city's streets, tenements, and hospitals. And the words he penned, often on deadline with a little time to spare, make him immortal in the annals of journalism. Dan Barry, reporter and columnist at the New York Times, carries many of those same journalism traits himself. One of journalism's great storytellers, Dan Barry is the author of a small shelf of books, including his most recent collection of his Times columns called This Land, America Lost and Found. And now Dan Barry has done a mitzvah, as we say in Brooklyn, by editing a new book of Jimmy Breslin's work, one that hopefully will introduce him to a new generation. It's called Breslin Selected Writings. It's just been published by the Library of America, that wonderful nonprofit publisher that preserves and celebrates great American writing. The book includes more than 70 columns that Breslin wrote over his career, from his earliest stories about horse racing and boxing and gangsters and civil rights marches and the famous story about the man who dug the grave for John F. Kennedy, to the tales from the era of AIDS, of police brutality, and even about Donald Trump's outrageous ego decades before that noxious character seized the national spotlight. It also includes two of Breslin's books, including his saga of Watergate, How the Good Guys Finally Won, and my favorite, about a Mexican immigrant laborer killed on a dangerous construction job in Brooklyn, The Short, Sweet Dream of Eduardo Gutierrez. Breslin, Essential Writings, it's a telling introduction to an American master. Dan Barry, thank you for doing this book and for being here this evening to talk about it.
Oh, thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me. It's an honor.
The honor's ours. Yeah, Jim, you know, when Breslin died in 2017, New York gave him a royal send-off, a big funeral, lots of important people, a eulogy by the governor, long obituaries, stories on the evening news. But that was it. I don't know about you, but it seemed to me that Breslin might well just fade away, one of those old-school reporters whose day had passed, which is why I'm so glad you did this book. Was that part of your thinking in deciding to take it on?
Yeah, it's interesting. As I talk to younger reporters, in fact, just the other night I was at some event and I was talking about this because I constantly talk about myself. But no, I was talking about Breslin and this young person had never heard of him. And I think she was in her 30s. And I said, oh, my goodness. But I thought that he absolutely warranted this kind of a collection. And I did think that for those who were unfortunate not to have known or read him back in the day, here was another chance. And reading this stuff, I had to go through pretty much everything he'd ever written. Stuff included in the volume really holds up, I think.
I think it does. You remember when you first started reading Jimmy Breslin?
You know, growing up, Long Island, my father was a Depression-era guy from New York City. He swore by Breslin. So I would come down as a kid, and my father wasn't a very affectionate guy, but, the first thing he would say is, read Breslin today. That's how my mornings would often begin, read Breslin today. And so it was, in my house, Breslin was kind of scripture.
Yeah.
So I don't remember a time when he was not looming in my life.
That's such a great description of your old man and
yeah.
Going home and wanting to read Breslin. You know, I've heard you tell this story, but it's a fascinating one about the first time you actually met Jimmy Breslin. It was kind of unusual.
Yeah, so as I said, grew up reading Breslin, really worshipped him. But, that didn't distinguish me from pretty much any young journalist of my generation. We all, in our own way, tried to write like him, and that meant that we all failed. But I banged around. I had jobs at other newspapers, and I finally, got hired at the New York Times through, some clerical error. And I'm writing one of the greatest jobs I've ever had, perhaps the greatest. It was the About New York column for the New York Times. And
right.
It really was
right.
Just writing about anything I wanted as I wandered around the streets. So in the course of writing it in the early 2000s, I was diagnosed with a bad form of cancer. And, it was pretty grim there for a while. I have no idea, Tom, but Breslin found out. Okay, I knew Ronnie. I knew Ronnie, his wife, from my coverage of City Hall at one point. But somehow Breslin heard that I was going through cancer treatment. And one day my phone rings, and it's Breslin. And he says, yeah, Breslin, when are you going to that place? I said, you know, when are you going over there to that place? I knew what he was talking about, even though he never said it. He meant Memorial Sloan Kettering on the east side. And I said, I have to go there on Thursday for, you know, a scan or whatever the heck it was. Good. I'll go with you. So, like, what do you mean you're going to go with me? Anyway, so we arranged to meet at Broadway and 72nd Street. You know, I've never met him. He's never met me, but I know what he looks like. And as soon as we meet, he just begins telling stories. And we're walking east, you know, towards the park and then into the park. And he's talking about Gotti. He's talking about old boxers. He's talking about journalism. He's talking about the Daily News and the New York Times and the wise guys he knew. And it is just transporting. I'm lost and I'm laughing as I'm walking across the park. As I'm walking to something pretty serious, right? And then suddenly I'm in front of Sloan Kettering. And I said, you know, Mr. Breslin, thanks, Jimmy. I said, okay, Jimmy, thanks very much for walking me over. He says, I'll go up with you. The building with me. And then I check in. And my wife is with us by now, which means by now he has stopped cursing. Before my wife appeared, every other word was an F-bomb, but uh-huh. Once my wife appeared, that stopped. And so I go into the room, I get into my little Johnny, which is kind of embarrassing and everything, and then I'm ushered into this small waiting room, and in that small waiting room is my wife and Jimmy Breslin, okay? It's like we're in a closet together, so I'm with my wife and I'm with my lifelong hero, and I'm in a Johnny. And he continues to distract, he continues to tell stories. He continues to, like, charm the nurses. And then finally the gurney comes, and they're going to roll me into this procedure. And he's, like, right next to the gurney. And the joke is that I made room for him on the gurney so he could hop on. But he finally left. And I went into the procedure. And you know, it wasn't good. It wasn't good news. And so the next day I was walking around the city. I remember I was around the Flatiron Building just walking around feeling sorry for myself. And my phone rang, and it was Breslin. He said, what do you got for tomorrow, meaning my column? I said, you know what, Jimmy, I thought I wasn't going to write anything. I thought I was going to take the day off. That offended him. He says, no way. Story on the curb. Look on the pavement. There are stories everywhere. Right.
That's a Breslin story. That's a great. He had.
So I had to write a column, and it was you know he basically dared me, so I had to write it, and of course you know Tom he knew Sloan Kettering quite well because that's where his first wife Rosemary had been treated and where she died, and that's where one of his daughters.
Right.
Was treated for a long time before her passing. So it meant a lot to him. And, you know, to me, it was a reflection of his, you know, big heart in contrast to his rough persona.
Yeah. And of what he thought about you, Dan Barry, I think, in a way, that he recognized you, however much you might think it's weak to in comparison, a lot of us would disagree with that, and I think James Breslin was one of them, which was why he wanted to see you. That's a long walk, by the way, from 72nd and Broadway over to York Avenue.
It flew because the guy was like, it was like so entertaining and funny, and I totally forgot where I was going.
Well, you know, you read through this terrific collection that you put together, and it strikes me all over again how Jimmy Breslin managed to be so many times where big things were happening. You know, he's famous for having written about the doctors emergency room one at Parkland Hospital in Dallas the day John F. Kennedy was shot, and even more famous for writing about the gravedigger who dug the plot for Kennedy's grave.
Right.
We'll talk about him a little later. But as you point out, Dan, he did something else, which was just taken from a completely a curveball, right after the funeral on Thanksgiving Day. He wrote a column about a bunch of old guys sitting in the automat on 8th Avenue.
Right.
Had you seen that before? Because I didn't remember it till you pointed it out.
No, I hadn't. And we have to put ourselves back in November of 1963. So he basically debriefs the doctor who's presented with Kennedy, who's dead if not, dying if not already dead. And then he goes, as we know, to the gravedigger. And then he comes back to New York. And from what I understand from Ronnie and from his children, he really took everything personally. He would go out on the streets and he would write about, some single mother in the Bronx going through something. And he would write the story and he would come home and he would go to bed because he would be so overtaken by the emotions of the situation. So just imagine Breslin going through, being at the hospital, then talking to the gravedigger. Then he comes back to New York, and he decides on Thanksgiving, which is only a few days after Kennedy's death, to go to this automat. And he's describing these lonely men sitting by themselves, drinking coffee, and just killing time. And if you don't mind, I'll read the last two paragraphs of it.
Okay? Yeah, please.
Outside 8th Avenue was vacant. A few cabs moved by, now and then a bus. The few people on the street were old and alone. There were some post office workers. They were paid yesterday, and they scouted around 8th Avenue for some place open so they could cash the check. Otherwise, it was a vacant day in the automat. Which was right? Yesterday was a day meant to be vacant. It seemed right to sit on Thanksgiving Day and put our butts in a coffee cup and every once in a while have an attendant in white shirt and slacks reach past your shoulder and take crumpled napkins from the table. So in that piece, he never once mentions the assassination. He never once mentions Kennedy. But what he's doing is saying the entire nation is weeping and grieving and feeling alone. And the crumpled napkins, could be from, a coffee spill, but really the crumpled napkins are to wipe away our tears, our collective tears. And he says that without saying it. That's powerful.
A special touch and a special insight, I think, into understanding where people were at. This is Deadline NYC, is the name of the show, folks. We're on WBAI 99.5 FM. My name's Tom Robbins. I'm talking to Dan Barry, who just edited a new collection of writings by the late, great Jimmy Breslin, New York columnist and writer extraordinaire. It's published by Library of America. Breslin Essential Writings, it's called. And among those, you've got Breslin did a number of columns about the civil rights marches in the South. He went down to Selma to march with Martin Luther King and James Lewis and others to Selma to Montgomery, and he did a column in which he focused on the last man in line, a bricklayer named Albert Turner, who had decided that since the government took $27.52 out of his paycheck every week, he deserved the right to vote. I read reread that column, and I just had to chuckle because, there's a couple of things that Breslin could have put in a textbook if he'd ever put one down on table about, he's going to talk about going where nobody else was, but to find the last guy online and the guys with a story about I deserve the right to vote. It was really just like it was such a typical Breslin maneuver. I'm really glad that you included that.
What he also did was he went into one of the segregated classrooms for the black children in Alabama and he was talking to some kids. And what he did was he took note of the textbooks. They were in the schoolhouse, and they were ratty old volumes from the 1930s, which was a reflection of how Alabama viewed its young black residents. And Breslin just nailed it.
Yeah, no, it's a really powerful and gloomy description of a place where students couldn't possibly learn, even with the greatest will in mind. But he put you right there.
Right.
You know, another thing that Jimmy was great at, you know, was he really had a wicked pen when he wanted to use it. He could be absolutely lacerating. And one of the ones that you included in here, he was once a great friend and fond of former New York State Governor Hugh Carey. But then things went south, okay? And Breslin really soured on his old friend, and he started dubbing him Society Carey. And I remember when he did it, it was just a name that stuck for a lot of us as we were reading his columns there in the early 80s. And reading it again in your collection, you know, I was thinking, you know, I wonder, made me wish we had someone dubbing our current governor who sent the National Guard into the city's subways, Brigadier General Hochul. Can't we get that into the newspapers today?
I know.
You think that's what Breslin would have?
You know, yeah. Breslin was once very close to Carey, and I don't know whether, you know, either Carey had, you know, and this is a cardinal sin for a guy like Breslin, you know, to forget your past, to forget where you came from, which is also in the Irish Catholic world, you know, the worst thing you can do is to forget where you came from.
Uh-huh.
And so I don't know whether Breslin thought that Carey, if you remember, you know, was dyeing his hair red or something at one point.
He remarried a wealthy woman, which also is one of the things.
And he was flying around a lot in his helicopter and all this kind of stuff. Right. So I don't know whether that was offensive to Breslin, or whether Breslin just needed a column one day.
There was that. You know what I mean? There was that. I remember after 9/11, Jimmy wrote a column condemning Barbara Streisand because she hadn't come to the city to sing. And I asked him, I said, what, where did you come? Where'd you get that? Like, what made you do that? And he said, I needed a column. You know, I got to tell you that, you know, I think I was among the readers who got so wedded to reading Breslin's columns, I would have read him if he was printing the phone book, which he almost came close to doing a few times. But I remember sometime in the early 80s, I'm not sure exactly when, he wrote a novel in the Daily News columns, and like against Deadline, and serialized it the way Dickens did. I think it was the one that was later called Table Money. And I remember, yeah, I remember being on the F train somewhere way above the Gowanus Canal in Brooklyn and folding the paper to read the latest chapter. He had that grip on you. It was really almost uncanny.
Yeah, you know, he so back in the 60s and 70s, he was included among the so-called new journalism writers, you know, the Tom Wolfes and the Gates Leases and some other fellows. And Breslin was often included in that. And I think Breslin was both, like, flattered and annoyed by the term, okay? Of course he would want to be included in a list of the best writers of the time, but he also thought it was a lot of nonsense because he said what he was doing was called sports writing. In other words, the techniques of storytelling and being able to write a short story in, say, 700 words, he said, you know, sports writers like Jimmy Cannon had been doing forever. That's one. Two, he would say, no, look at what Dickens was doing. That's what we're doing. And so it's interesting you bring up that serialization of a novel, which is, as you know, how Dickens also began doing serializations.
Yeah. No, it was, I mean, I, you know, he never called himself a journalist. That's one thing I remember. He insists, I'm a reporter. You know, don't call me
a
journalist.
Exactly right.
You know, I'm a working guy, not a professional. You got a bunch of columns in here from 1985, which is kind of a banner year for Jimmy Breslin. It was the year that resulted in his Pulitzer, but it started in late December of the prior year with the Bernie Goetz case. And Breslin was virtually alone in the city in the press at the time. You know, there was a lot of celebration of the so-called subway gunman after Goetz had shot down these young men who he said had menaced him in a subway car, shooting one in the back as he lay on the floor. And Breslin suggested if New Yorks were so proud of the subway gunman, you included one of the ones in your collection here. Why don't they run him for mayor? You want to read a short paragraph from that Getz column?
Sure. Just give me a second.
One of the four shot by Getz, Daryl Cabey. I'm thinking of the thing on, where is it? I think it's 405.
Right, I see it. Yeah, it's 405. Yeah. I happen to have a copy of the book right here, Tom.
Oh, what a guy.
his outrage was in every word. One of the four shot by Getz, Daryl Cabey, 19, went into his ninth day in a coma this morning. His backbone is severed because Getz shot him in the back. New Yorkers claim they stand ready to cheer Getz's actions. All right, then, let's go all the way. Cheer for gunfire and make Bernie Getz the mayor. That's unbelievable. Yeah. You want me to continue?
Well, I mean, the one I was going to segue to, which I don't know if you got it there, it's on 413. Yes. It was another one from the same year when his pal Marvin Kornberg, the great Queens Boulevard lawyer, tipped him to an incredible case of police brutality that Breslin called a type of torture, quote, usually associated with another century or continent. It was the use of electric prods on an 18-year-old black kid in a precinct basement, a guy named Mark Davidson who'd been arrested for selling $10 a pot to an undercover officer. I picked that up on 413. Right. Davidson says he turned.
Right. Sure. Davidson says he turned around and saw the tall man holding something that was black and fit in his hand and had two metal prongs about 6 inches long. The man then started to apply the prongs to Davidson's body, front and back, and sent shocks through him repeatedly. Davidson yelled. He says no other policeman entered the room to see what was causing the yelling. This sounds like something from another, from the 19th century, right. Or the early 20s or something. And this is happening in New York City in 1985. That's extraordinary.
And Breslin had this one alone. I mean, it was courtesy of his, he had a source, as we would say in the business, Marvin Kornberg, who said, this case is extraordinary. And he put Breslin onto it. But I think Jimmy wrote, at least half a dozen columns or something on it and just wouldn't let go because I think it so infuriated him. It was like a cop had a new toy that he wanted to try out. How important could the information be that 18-year-old Mark Davidson was holding back on about selling pot, that they would want to torture him with an electric cattle prod? It's just, it was unthinkable at the time, and it just really stunned everybody in the city until the cops did worse a few years later. But at the time, it was really
Even now, I'll meet old police officers, retired guys, and they'll either tell some wonderful story about Jimmy Breslin because they worship him, or they would tell the worst story possible about him. There were some police officers who thought he was betraying them. Mm. That he was an Irish Catholic guy from the boroughs, and he was betraying them by criticizing them, no matter what. Like, okay, so police officers using prods on a young man, you gotta call that out, and you have to express rage over it.
Right.
Not all police officers saw it that way, and I'm here to tell you, Breslin did not care. He did not care if he had offended a police officer or the police department. He did not care. He had a very strong moral compass, and I think for him that was an easy one. You don't put prods on a young man in the name of the New York City.
Yeah. And I guess right around that time, I remember the Police Benevolent Association started running full-page ads in the tabloids condemning Jimmy Breslin, naming him, calling him out, and talking about what he was doing to the people of New York by insulting New York's finest and condemning them. And I remember Murray Kempton, his colleague at Newsday, and a little later, was – he won his own Pulitzer. And I remember him saying at the time, you know, the biggest award that any journalist could get was the ads that the PBA ran against James Breslin. you know, we have this piece of tape that I have from Jimmy spoke to a class I taught at Hunter College a few years back. I just asked him to talk. I didn't have to do anything like to urge him on. I just said, talk to these folks. And it was a class, I guess, of about 15 students at the time, and in the evening, someplace in a remote room in the back of Hunter College. And Jimmy, who got lost on the way there, finally found his way in, and he just started talking, and he told this story. Reggie Johnson, we got that tape queued up. You want to try and play this little 4-minute splice?
Nobody was ever going to give you anything. They still won't. I don't think. No.
So you would just go out and get stories?
That's all you should do. Your time is your career. I mean, days off, it's crazy. Don't take them. Just go out and get something and keep doing it until you get a good enough job. You don't have to go out anymore on your day off. You know, it's a great thing. You can go out and get it. There's something out all over the place. You can always get a story. Just turn it in. Nobody's going to turn down a good story. Same with the television. How would they not take anything if you had a camera? Somehow you got a hold of a camera that took a film of something you knew was good. Nobody else was there. Just look for something that nobody else is going to be there. That's the best. Don't go where the crowd goes. Jesus, that's death. That is truly death. If I had anything that helped me make a living in this business, it was a great aversion to being with somebody else. If I go there and there's reporters, I might as well go home. I don't like it. It's going to be everybody the same. I mean, that was the one piece I wrote that they talk about in school books or something, was when Kennedy was shot, they had to kill the President Kennedy. They had a funeral. I went to the White House for the funeral, and there were 3,000 reporters there. There were some great sights. I still remember Charles de Gaulle of France and a lieutenant's uniform, simple uniform, talking to Haile Selassie of Ethiopia, who was this tall and had plumes and sabers. It was a great picture, but what good was that going to do me? So I said, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to the funeral. The key to a funeral is the body. Where do you put the body? So I'm going to get the guy that digs the grave. So there were 3,000 reporters. I can't make a living with 3,000 people. Come on. So I remember I went inside the White House to where they were all packed in there, too. And I saw Art Buchwald, who was a friend of mine, and he worked on the same paper, the New York Herald Tribune. That thing is gone. And I told him, I'm going to go over to the cemetery and get the grave digger. And he said, that's a good idea. Now, that's all I needed. Just to make me comfortable was the voice of one guy who's smart enough to know what I was thinking. And with that in mind, I went over to the cemetery, and I found the guy that dug the grave, and I wrote about it. Just his time getting the job and doing it. He got $3.01 an hour. I knew that. And I wrote it, and it did terrific the next day, and maybe for that story anyway. But the key to it was is to be alone, be by yourself. Don't have anybody near you. Jesus, they're terrible. Why do you want to work? Why do you want somebody else? So that's it. That's why since then I've tried that. But we did that. I'm cheating a little bit. I'm claiming like it was my own brilliance that found it. We always did it in the sports, where I came out of the sports department. You always went to the loser's dressing room because there's nobody there in a language was the best.
A few lines in there.
Oh, my God.
Matched.
Oh, my God.
That's pretty.
I was just listening to that, and I'm all by myself, and I'm smiling and I'm nodding. I'm nodding at everything he says, including, you know, the key to being a good reporter is to be effectively antisocial. You don't want to hang around with other reporters. I've always felt that way, and it's so interesting to hear him verbalize it.
Don't go where the crowd is. That's death.
No, it's death.
His acknowledgement at the end there, like, notches exactly what you were just saying about sports writing. You know, he said, "I just cheating. That's what we did in sports. We went to the losers' locker room." He then went on to tell the Murray Kemp and Don Larson losing pitcher of the great game there. But Jimmy was, you know, like in fine form that day and telling a young generation of possible reporters, a couple of them went into the business after that class, I think, about how it was done. And he was always very generous with his time, I think. He was always willing to show up for that stuff. Folks, yeah. This is WBAI 99.5 FM. The show's called Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins. More importantly, I'm talking to Dan Barry, the great New York Times columnist and writer who's just edited a new collection of the writings of Jimmy Breslin, published by the Library of America. I can't recommend it too highly to folks. Let's go on with some of his columns. You know, we were in 85, and that was the same year that he started writing about people suffering from AIDS, which was quietly devastating the city. And then it was a time when a lot of people believed it was contagious. But Breslin, you know, sat down in the hospital in the living rooms with victims, and he wrote one of the columns was about a young man from rural Georgia, from a very conservative family, but who ended up in St. Vincent's Hospital, where he was told by his father that he was paying the price for his sins and by his insurance company that he owed $18,000.76. But there's a couple of graphs. I don't know if you can find them where.
Yeah, I have it.
Go ahead.
Sure. When he looked up in the recovery room, he saw his mother and one of his sisters. A nun came and took them for a cup of coffee. He was in intensive care when a doctor walked in and began poking at his gland. He remembers saying to himself, "Is he giving me an AIDS exam?" His mother was there the next time the doctor came in. "You have Kaposi sarcoma," the doctor said. "One of them was on an artery. That caused you trouble. There are 10 or 12 more in there." He remembers, "What does that mean?" his mother said. He remembers mumbling to his mother, "That is the cancer you get when you have AIDS." He and his mother looked at each other. Now the life he never talked about was part of the family album. That's unbelievable.
Part of the family album. Yeah, you know.
Part of the family album, yeah.
You know, it was interesting that Jimmy Breslin extended himself to folks who were really far outside his normal comfort range, let's just say. You know, I mean, he was a guy from Queens. He was, you know, liked hanging out. And yet, the comfort that he felt talking to these folks at the time, you know, looking at them, whatever it is, 35, 40 years later, is so crystal clear, you know, that he was right there with this young man, you know, trying to deal both with a fatal illness and with letting his parents know that he had a life that he hadn't talked about. Tough stuff.
I think Breslin understood suffering. He understood personal crisis, and he understood fear and loss of life. You know, and he understood it from his own personal life, and he was able to be so empathetic, and there was no inauthenticity to it. When he's writing these things, you could almost hear him, you know, sighing and being with that person in empathy. And as I said earlier, I'm sure he wrote this and went home and had to lay down.
Right. You know, that was one of the things I most appreciated about hearing you talk about the book was his wife Ronnie Eldridge's story about that. And that was the way he dealt with it. He just lay down in bed. Trying to deal with these things. I promised people at the beginning of this that I was going to say something about what he had Donald Trump's number way back in 1990. And he did this wonderful column, which seems so prescient. I'm so glad you included it here in this collection, about focusing on the press and the media's excitement about this rich young developer. And I don't know, you want to see if you can find a piece of that makes sense to you to read in this column here?
Sure. You know, this column is a gimlet-eyed look at Trump, but it's also a harsh assessment of the media at that time, particularly in New York City, where many in the media were like in awe of Trump and loved getting a call from him. So he writes, Donald Trump handles these nitwit reporters with a new and most disgraceful form of bribery, about which I will tell you. He uses the reporters to create razzle-dazzle. There are 5 stories in the newspapers and the morning papers leading to 11 minutes of television at night. The financial people who lead such dreary lives believe what they read and see on television. Trump is larger than life. No, not Trump. Don't use that name. It's Donald. He cannot lose. The financial geniuses can't wait to rush into the glamour and lights. They want to touch Trump's arm. Here, I'm from Prudential, the Rock of Gibraltar. Take our $75 million to build another crap game. Can I ride on your boat? Oh, man. He calls out the New York Times, you know, the same thing, you know. He says Trump bought reporters from morning papers to nightly news with 2 minutes of purring over the phone. I just talked to Donald. I heard somebody say in the place where I work, Donald called, and Breslin would have absolutely none of it. It's and he also had Giuliani's number.
Yes,
you know the famous line. A small man in search of a balcony.
What do you say? Something along. It's in one of the columns about, I hadn't remembered, it's a cynical man with a sneer or a something guy with a sneer. I forget. But and it was funny because obviously we haven't talked about it, but Jimmy Breslin helped make Rudy Giuliani because he brought him his first big witness in what became the biggest case that Rudy Giuliani did in Massimil corruption when a friend of Breslin from Queens Boulevard confessed that he'd been a bagman for the Queensboro president, Donald Mandis. And Giuliani called him after Dowd showed up and said, thanks for the witness. And it obviously didn't earn him any gratitude from Breslin, who wasted no time on him from there on. I greatly admired Breslin's ability to handle politicians, which was kind of amazing since he was married to one. You know, Ronnie Eldridge is she was a city council person, you know, and she's one of the few politicians that I greatly admire. And she certainly had to walk on eggshells sometimes, depending on what her husband was writing in the paper that day, but she got by.
I know.
You want to talk?
They would be right about their family life.
Well, yes. Okay. So, I don't know if you want. It was Ronnie had what, 3 kids, and he had 6. I forget. And he talked about that.
I think it was that. Yes, exactly
The mixed family, and he used to love the wars that would happen because none of them could talk to each other. To him, it was great.
I think people who might be younger may not have a complete understanding of just how big Breslin was. And that's how he would sometimes refer to himself. He would say, I'm big.
Yes.
Right? So there was a serial killer around New York when the serial killer, who came to be known as Son of Sam, wanted to reach out. Who does he reach out to? He sends a letter to Jimmy Breslin. And he uses the familial with Breslin as though he's like kind of friends with him. It's as though Son of Sam, who is actually David Berkowitz, knows Breslin through Breslin's writing. And so this guy writes this horrible, scary letter saying effectively that the killings are going to continue, right?
Right.
And so Breslin describes the first column, I think, he describes sitting there and opening up this letter. Can you just imagine getting that letter from this madman who's got the city like in a living nightmare, basically? And so Breslin writes about it, and then he continues to write about it. And it gets criticized. Right. There are people like Gary Trudeau and Doonesbury and The New Yorker who criticized Breslin because they thought that he was milking a tragedy, that he was milking a citywide trauma. And Breslin always defended himself, saying he had been asked by the NYPD, actually, to continue this kind of like public engagement with this character called Son of Sam, because they were hoping that in one of these letters they might be able to pick up a fingerprint or some other kind of DNA that would help to crack the case.
You think that bothered Jimmy Breslin, that he was getting criticized in The New Yorker and Doonesbury at the time?
Not at all. Like that he was suddenly a figure in a very popular comic strip.
Well, you know, I mean, it's an amazing saga of journalism, because you're absolutely right. I mean, here was this guy bent on terrorizing New York City and murdering young people in the streets, and yet, who did he want to talk to? He wanted to talk to Jimmy Breslin. Jimmy Breslin run his letters in the paper. We got about 10 minutes to go. I wanted to touch on the books that you included in this great collection. You know, you have the Watergate book about the good guys finally won, which is a wonderful saga of the people that you really don't hear about in the Watergate story. It's not the Washington Post. It's really Tip O'Neill, and it's the people on the staffs of the House Committee. But Breslin sort of decamped to D.C. to do that book. Had you read it before you put it into the book, Dan?
You know, I read it before many years ago, and rereading it for this collection, it was at the suggestion of one of the editors at the Library of America to include it, because, you know, I was wondering, oh, do we include The Church That Forgot Christ or another book?
Right.
But the editor suggested this one because, quite frankly, it resonates with today.
Right.
And what Breslin did was he was a fly on the wall as the mechanisms in Washington are dealing with an impeachment, and they're dealing with a profound crisis for the nation, and how they handle it with integrity, right? How they handle it, you know, step by step so as not to screw up. And that everyone who figures in the story cares ultimately about their oath to the country and not about their political aspirations. And it was, I think it was smart of the Library of America to include it, if only to remind us as we go through some of the similar things today of what matters.
Right. Yeah, no, I remember at the time when I first read it, you know, thinking this is a story which I did not know. I thought I knew the story of Watergate, but this piece of it, I didn't know. And you had a book that you included, as I mentioned, I think it's my favorite. He wrote a bunch of books, but The Short Sweet Dream of Eduardo Gutierrez was, I think, Breslin's really most rage-filled book. It also another wonderfully empathetic tale, this one really of an immigrant love story and a tragic ending to it. And it's about how this guy, immigrant from Mexico in search of work, had gone to work in this very dangerous place in Williamsburg, and then he was, because of the shoddy workmanship by the developer, there was this crash and he died. And you know, you and I both covered this story, Dan, when it happened. You were at the Times, I guess I was at the News, and then later at the Voice. I kept going on it, and it was such an important story for the politics of it. You know, I remember you wrote about some of the Giuliani aides who had accommodated this developer, who had managed to get a slide from But Breslin includes that part in his book, and there's a lot of politics in there. But he also goes right into the tragedy itself in a way that I remember being so struck when I read it about his description. You want to? There's a couple of graphs about the moment when the house, the building they were working on, collapsing. You got that part? You want to read it?
Yeah, bear with me. There was no swaying or quivering, no time even for a warning gasp from somebody. An instant, a shrug of concrete and metal, and the floor under Eduardo went. Down Eduardo went so quickly that nobody screamed. Down went Alejandro, Lucino, and Gustavo, and two Angels and Juan. Down they went so quickly that nobody screamed. The third floor fell into the second floor, and the second fell into the first, and everything fell into the basement. The rear wall blew out, as did a wall that was supposed to be tied to the building. There was a cascade of cinder blocks and metal. What were supposed to be metal beams holding up the floors were as strong as aluminum foil. Eduardo fell face first into 3 feet of concrete on the basement floor and drowned.
Yeah, I thought that was some of the most powerful writing that certainly in that book and that Jimmy did, you know, to... It was like, talk about putting you there.
So powerful. Floors. And as you and I both know, this continues to happen.
Yeah. No, the rage in the city was fed by his stories back then and by the stories you wrote at the same time, Dan, about how in the world was this allowed to happen. I mean, nobody was really ever held criminally responsible for this thing. One guy copped a plea in federal court and... That was kind of the end of it, but, you know, the saga of Eduardo Gutierrez. I remember after he finished with it, he stayed on the case because there was supposed to be a payment made to Gutierrez's family, and it wasn't coming through. It was being blocked in surrogate's court in Brooklyn. And Jimmy was as irate about that as he had been about the original incident because he wanted to get that money to the family.
Yeah.
And he and Ronnie Eldridge, his wife, they actually went down to Mexico to chase this story. You know, they wanted to see the border. They wanted to see the funeral for Eduardo Gutierrez at his village. And they also, they went looking for places where Eduardo and his girlfriend had crossed the border. And I heard this story originally from Ronnie, but it's mentioned in the book. I noticed in looking at it again while they were driving around someplace near Nogales in the border of Arizona in Mexico, they spot a mailman, and they go over to ask him for directions. And the guy looks up and says, Jesus Christ, it's Jimmy Breslin. That was some guy named Tom McAlpin, who was born in Cabrini Hospital, as Jimmy notes in the book. They had a conversation only in Breslin world. There's one last piece I want to catch from this before we go, because I think it's just such poetry that he wrote, and that was Breslin's description of the funeral procession when he got there. You want to read that part?
Sure. The young women carrying his casket were friends of Eduardo. Their faces were determined. Soon, however, they cried as they made Eduardo's casket dance. Sway forward on the left leg, sway back on the right foot, sway forward, sway back, sway, 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 dance the young man to his grave.
Yeah, sway, sway, sway.
That's poetry. I mean, so... You know, we've been talking about his effect as a journalist and a reporter, but he was really, really a writer. He was achieving literature on Deadline and in nonfiction time and time again, and that's just one example.
Man, I think it's so true. You know, I mean, he didn't connect every time, but he connected so many times with so many big stories. It's really, when you look back at the whole oeuvre of Breslin stuff, it's really incredible how many times he was there and managed to somehow feel that visceral connection. Well, we did as much as we could here, Dan. We didn't get to Crown Heights, we didn't get to some other stuff, but we're going to leave it there. You know, I want to recommend to people, Dan mentioned something about his own life. He wrote a memoir called Pull Me Up. Do I have the name right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a wonderful story. I commend that to folks, in addition to Dan Barry's collection that I mentioned at the beginning about America, this land, America lost and found. Dan Barry, thank you so much for being here, for doing the book, and for hanging out with us this evening. I really appreciate it.
Really a privilege, Tom, and thank you. Thank you so much for I just love talking about Breslin, so it's great. It's great.
All right. All right, we're going to leave it there. Thanks, Reggie Johnson, for doing some ace engineering. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. We'll let Eddie Lockjaw Davis steal the last few moments of this show with Oliver Nelson's Stolen Moment. Take care, everyone.
I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the headlines. This weekend begins the holy month of Ramadan, a time of fasting and prayer for a billion Muslims worldwide. The first night was marked by fighting between worshippers and Israeli police at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, one of Islam's holiest sites. The next morning, barbed wire was seen being rolled out by the authorities. Meanwhile, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for a truce.
Honor the spirit of Ramadan by silencing the guns and removing all obstacles to ensure the delivery of life-saving aid at the speed and massive scale required.
Guterres also called for the release of hostages held by Hamas. Talks towards a ceasefire and release of the captives have stalled, with some aid being airdropped by the United States. Thousands of aid trucks remain parked outside Gaza, unable to pass through Israeli inspection points. At least 20 people have died of starvation in Gaza over the past few days. More than a million Palestinians are penned into the southernmost Gaza Strip at Rafah, where at least 16 premature infants have died. Israel had threatened to invade the area if a treaty wasn't agreed by the start of Ramadan. The head of the United Nations Commission on Human Rights is Jeremy Lawrence.
Any ground assault on Rafah would incur massive loss of life and would heighten the risk of further atrocity crimes. This must not be allowed to happen. We also fear that further Israeli restrictions on access by Palestinians to East Jerusalem and the Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan could further inflame tensions.
In related news, Sunday night was the Oscar Awards ceremony honoring the best film of the year, according to Hollywood. Many attendees sported buttons calling for a ceasefire. The film, Zone of Interest, about the Holocaust, won for Best International Film. British director Jonathan Glazer used his acceptance speech to denounce the war against Gaza.
Right now, we stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people.
In more national news, presidential candidate Donald Trump used a campaign speech in Georgia on Saturday to mock President Joe Biden for his stutter.
State of the Union address, wasn't it, didn't it bring us together? Remember, he said, I'm going to bring the country together. I'm going to bring it together.
Trump has gone after various people's disabilities during his campaigns. Meanwhile, former President Trump has changed his position on the Chinese-owned social media giant TikTok that's wildly popular in the United States. Members of Congress have been pushing for a bill to force TikTok's owners to sell to an American company. Recently, Trump, famous for his antipathy to China, flipped and decided to oppose a measure targeting TikTok. The Civil Liberties Director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation is David Green. He says he supports Trump's new position, but adds the former president isn't offering a real solution.
Does he support comprehensive data privacy regulation that would truly protect the privacy interests of U.S. people, as opposed to something which is largely performative like a TikTok ban?
Green adds the anger towards social media in Congress is not unusual when the industry being regulated is protected by free speech rights.
I think an expression of legislative frustration that communications platforms before them have really strong constitutional rights, and that results in some frustration by those who tried to regulate them.
Trump on Monday said he still thinks TikTok is a security risk, but banning the site would just help Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, who Trump says is an enemy of the people. And in local news, speaking at a church last night for an FDNY promotion ceremony, New York State Attorney General Tish James was booed by some firefighters who chanted Trump, Trump, Trump. Later, FDNY Commissioner Laura Cavanaugh made a public apology. The commissioner said Sunday at the same church, on behalf of the New York City Fire Department, I'm sorry. And in sad news for the WBAI Pacifica radio community, Malachi McCourt, co-host of Radio Free Iron, died on Monday. Cab driver and WBAI veteran John McDonough said McCourt